Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Hey, Mark, as you know, we always like to educate our audience. Mm-hmm. And again on the show today, we have Jeff Carr, who's already been on our podcast before. But we love to have repeat performances. Jeff Carr needs no introduction. He's perhaps the most knowledgeable economist in the EB5 industry. And what Jeff has done is he's prepared a report, an amazing report actually, alongside IIUSA, who we've talked about a lot of times, and EB5 Investment Coalition, who did not always see eye to eye with IIUSA. So it's very interesting that he's been the conduit between the two for this report. And we've asked him today to come on the show and discuss this report with us, because I feel everybody in the industry needs to know about this. They need to understand, whether you're here in the US and you're advocating for the EB5 industry, or whether you're overseas thinking about investment in the US, or whether you're a developer thinking about putting up a project here in the U.S.
You're right, Mona. Jeff really doesn't need an introduction, but in case people haven't heard that episode that we did with him 3 years ago on target employment areas, I'm going to go ahead.
It was three years ago.
We've been around for a while. So I want to go ahead and give just a brief introduction to our audience that may not know Jeff or have had heard his past episode. So that way they'll know exactly why that he's the person to have on the show to talk about this economic topic. So Jeff Carr is the president and senior economist of Economic and Policy Resources Incorporated, and has more than 35 years of experience as an economist analyst, and has done hundreds of economic impact studies and EB5 project business plan writing assessments. Mr. Carr has lectured extensively on the EB5 programs on matters throughout the world. And as we've said, he's also a returning speaker here on EB5 Investment Voice. Jeff Carr, welcome back to the show.
Delighted to be back on an issue of such importance at this critical time for the Regional Center Program.
Thanks, Jeff. I know a lot of people do understand that we need an economic report, but even before we dive into this amazing project that you've done, I would like to explain for the first-time listeners, or maybe the attorneys who really don't understand how the EB5 Regional Center Program works, why do we need an economist?
Well, we need an economist basically to keep score on the number of jobs that are created by EB5 investment projects for the purposes of making sure that all the EB5 investors in each one of the projects gets the required 10 jobs per investor so that they can receive their immigration benefits that they're asking for.
So if I am a first-time lawyer or even an investor, I would have thought, wait a minute, I can count the jobs. I don't need an economist. I can see, look, 1, 2, 3. Why do I need an economist?
Well, because you can count jobs that are not directly tied to the project site out in the economy, for example, from suppliers or vendors that are supplying building materials to a building project. And then you can also count the jobs from all the jobs that are created on site and at those suppliers and vendors when they take their income and go to the movies, buy cars, buy clothes and groceries and those kinds of things. And we economists have methods that use government data to count the jobs that aren't readily apparent to the eye of the person looking at the project site. They're called the multiplier effect jobs, which is analogous to throwing a stone in the middle of the puddle and seeing the ripples go out to the edges. We have a techniques and methods that have been approved by the USCIS to count the jobs associated with those ripples.
I should really bring out at this point that economic reports and the type of jobs that you've described, in direct and induced jobs, are only available for a regional center project, or rather an EB5 project that is being put through a designated regional center. It doesn't work for, it doesn't count for a direct project or a direct boot project.
Because direct jobs, we have to count them through actual I-9s and W-2 filings that prove that a job was there and that there was a person who is eligible to work at that job at the subject business. And we can't count the jobs that happen at the suppliers and vendors or as a result of the jobs that are created by the project, their family spending their income.
And that sounds like that's probably the motivation for you to do this study, right?
Yes, and in part it was. You know, the EB-5 program now is experiencing a little bit of uncertainty because we can't get the policymakers to make a decision to give us a long-term extension or give us an adequate number of visas. In many ways, the program, the regional center part of the program, is actually being punished because it's been so successful in raising foreign capital and creating jobs that we've run out of visas and we need a few additional visas. So we thought when we were first approached by the investment coalition that we needed to do an industry-wide consensus on just what was the job creation and other impacts associated with the capital investment that happens in the regional center program. We're focused on the regional center program because that's the one that needs the authorization. The direct program, which just counts the jobs at the business itself, is a permanent program. The regional center program needs a reauthorization roughly every 3 years.
Right. That makes sense.
But my point also, Jeff, I know we were squabbling about this issue earlier, is that because of the regional center program, it really does attract more people into direct projects as well. And when Congress is considering the amount of money or the economic impact of this program, you really have to tie the both together.
Well, we would if we could. As you may know, when we did this study about the economic impact and the jobs created by the EB-5 Regional Center Program, we were able to utilize an approach where we went to the federal government and filed a Freedom of Information Act request through IIUSA Industry Group to obtain all the reports, which are compulsory and required by the USCIS, of all the regional centers throughout the country. So if there was a project that was not in a regional center project, there wasn't a good way for us to get information on that direct project because they don't use a regional center. And in part because the regional center part of the program is the one that needs to be reauthorized and the direct program is permanent, we wanted to stay on point in terms of developing the facts to make a case for supplying more visas to the regional center program and to give us a longer term authorization, which would give us more stability for decision making in the program.
Jeff, I really appreciate what you're doing, and I appreciate this economic impact report that you have done. And we do want our audience to understand, first of all, why you did it, which you've explained very well, and really what the purpose is. In a nutshell, even before we go into what you've been looking at and some of the data, how much has the EB-5 program brought in?
We were able to obtain information on about $11 billion in capital investment associated with EB-5 projects in the regional center program over the federal government's 2014 and 2015 fiscal year. And the reason that we chose that was those were two periods of time when, A, we could get the information, and two, when the program wasn't constrained by concerns about not enough visas like it is right now.
Yeah.
And it wasn't impacted by a program sunset, which caused a rash or a rush of filings in order to try to beat the sunset filing. Now, federal fiscal years are a little bit different than calendar years because the 2014 federal fiscal year ends on September 30th of that year. And the federal fiscal year 2015 went from October 1st, 14 to September 30th of 15. So we were able to get two really good representative years of project activity under the EB-5 program from which to do our analysis. And as I said before, it represented $11 billion in capital investment that these programs brought to the table for this country, which is a considerable amount.
Well, if we also consider the amount which spins off from this $11 billion, in another podcast that we recently had, Mark and I heard how banks overseas, for example, start to do business in the United States when they've heard that a lot of their investors are investing in a certain project. So there is, other than people who are purchasing, say, real estate or putting money into businesses and stuff, as well as the EB-5, the amount of economic impact which comes in it has to be well over double the $11 billion.
We don't have any good information to know that, but we do know, for example, that every time we build something, if we build a hotel or we build a commercial building that has 50 floors or those types of things, we know that those projects have ongoing operations. Whether it's a hotel, it operates the hotel and people come and go and they have to provide them with, you know, food and drink and places to lay their heads every night. We also know that in a commercial building that has a whole bunch of tenants in it, all those tenants have ongoing businesses that create jobs both there and in other places around the country. And we aren't able to count those. This study doesn't count those at this point because we don't have a good handle on all that, because a lot of the projects nowadays are just filing to get their construction activity approved. And because of the way the program has drifted, a lot of people say, well, we know that there's operations, but we're not going to ask you to review that. And those are real contributions to the economy. The other thing the study didn't count was the substantial amount of economic activity that the investors themselves, when they come and set their households up in the United States, when they show up, they buy houses, they buy cars, and that's a substantial amount of activity. But we don't have a lot of good activity about where these households eventually land and live. For example, they could invest in a project in downtown New York City, but live in Los Angeles while that project is being developed in New York City or in Chicago or in Miami. Some people end up in Missouri, even though they invest in a project in LA. So there's not a good symmetry between where the investors themselves come and set up their households.
And that makes sense, right, Jeff? Because an economic analysis in this report, I mean, this isn't a creative writing assignment. You have approved economic models that the government has looked at and said, you know, these are appropriate models. Perhaps they're a little conservative. So it stands to reason that there's probably economic activity even greater than all the numbers that's being presented here, because these models are conservative, approved models from the government that says, yes, economists, if you use these types of models, we believe you. Vice every economist trying to come up with some creative writing project on what may be happening.
And what we wanted to do was make sure that we only scored the job impacts from verifiable and hard project data. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, even though the other two activities and even though the activity in the direct EB-5 program are substantial, we didn't want to bring those in because those would have been harder to develop and it would have been more susceptible to people saying, well, you don't really know. So this whole study is not of value. So we kept it to a very high standard on the project data that we brought in to the equation. And we got all of the regional center I-924 filings from this period and used their project data from those filings.
Jeff, there's often been a criticism that there are a lot of real estate construction projects, but I notice from your report that you mentioned a number of industries which are non-construction sectors.
Yeah, it's very broad-based. You know, there's a lot of projects that are in wholesale trade, healthcare. There's a lot of manufacturing project activity. There's also quite a bit of activity in educational services and also in arts and entertainment and recreation. So even though there's certainly a lot of activity in construction, the thing that shouldn't be lost is that even if we build something in a downtown in Miami or something like that, they don't fabricate the steel there. They usually fabricate it in the Midwest. And in downtown Los Angeles, there aren't any lumbering operations that are needed to help build the project. So we find that, you know, particularly in some parts of the country, that even though a project may be located far, far away, that project located far, far away, because of very robust supply chains that we have nowadays, can create jobs 1,000 miles away in another part of the country.
Right. Another criticism that we often hear is that the jobs and on all the investment has been really centered on areas like New York City and Los Angeles and Miami. But again, from your report, it's showing that that's not the case.
Well, here's an interesting fact. You know, we looked at four regions across the U.S. That are delineated by the U.S. Census Bureau. And in the Midwest, for example, which is, you know, kind of the industrial heartland, that was the part of the country that had the lowest amount of direct EB-5 investment in projects, only about $380 million. But the fact of the matter is that $380 million resulted in about 14, you know, it was only about 3.5% of the whole number of projects, but they got 14% of the total output and 13% of the jobs, because when investment happens in New York, Miami, Los Angeles, and Seattle, the components for those projects are made in the Midwest. And that creates jobs in the Midwest. So there's a lot of parochialism. You know, what about projects in my state? Well, what you need to understand is that in the Midwest, the predominant effect on the economy for job creation and output growth and income growth happened because of projects located in the Northeast, South, and West.
That's really educational, and it also shows that this program is used everywhere. It's not just a New York City program, which is, again, one of the criticisms we hear. Do you have a figure for the total number of jobs for U.S. workers for this period?
Yes, over that two-year period, across the whole country, this EB-5 capital investment of about $11 billion over that two-year period created just over 355,200 jobs nationally. For that period, Mona, that represented 6% of the total job growth in the entire country.
Wow. Wow. I really feel like that should be highlighted in bright yellow and stuck right at the very beginning, the middle and the end.
Yeah, it's just fascinating the amount of impact that the EB-5 Regional Center program has. You mentioned $11 billion, 355,200 jobs. I'm going to break out my calculator real quick. You like what I did there? It turns out that that is about $43,000 for every job created. So for every investor that puts in $43,000, and as we know, investors put in much more than that for projects, every $43,000 creates a U.S. job. That's both direct and indirect. And that's the kind of information that those on Capitol Hill need to know when they're contemplating what to do with the EB-5 program.
Jeff, I've heard a lot of criticism about the Redden model, and that perhaps RIMS 2 or one of the other implant would have been a better model to use. Why did you use the Redden?
Well, because the Redyn model, it's R-E-D-Y-N model.
Sorry, so it's not Redden. I've been saying Redden for the last 12 years.
Yes. Well, it is. It is a group of tools in this area that has dynamic features. It's called, for lack of a better term, a comprehensive geographic equilibrium model. It treats the economy as a single closed system. And we did that nationally, okay? The RIMS 2 multipliers and the IMPLAN models don't have that CGE capability. They're static models. And while some of the people in the industry like it because they can go to a spreadsheet and it's one number times another number equals the job impact. Mm-hmm. Okay. The simplicity of that actually misses all the robustness of the supply chain that I was talking about earlier. Those, if you buy RIMS 2 for New York City, RIMS 2 multipliers, you're only going to measure the effects of the project that happen in the New York City area for you built those bought those multipliers. They can't capture the steel job impact of the steel that's being manufactured in Indiana or in Illinois or Ohio. They can't capture the jobs associated with the fabrication of the windows in California because they don't cover that area. And the EB-5 program is a national jobs program. Every single time someone, as a case officer, has asked questions about the CGE capabilities of the Redyn model, we've been able to successfully explain it. And so why would a project not want to count all of the jobs nationally, which is allowed under the EB-5 program, created by a project? Because we know that we're not fabricating steel in downtown Miami, or we don't have any lumber mills in downtown Miami, but those jobs are being created by the construction project in downtown Miami. So don't limit yourself to a tool that can't calculate those jobs, because you're shortchanging your investors, you're shortchanging the project sponsors from the true and accurate accounting of the jobs that are created by each project.
Well, you're preaching to the converted here, but if anybody's out there is not sure, then I would think that that's a fantastic explanation, Jeff. I certainly prefer the Redyne model as opposed to any of the other models.
And Redyne's undergoing a significant upgrade now, so we expect it to be even more robust here in the next 6 months.
Can you explain to the listener where you obtained your data? Because obviously your model is only as good as the data you put in, and how you can assure the accuracy of the data.
And that's a very important point. And that goes to the collaboration that there was between the EB5 Investment Coalition and the Invest in the USA or IIUSA industry group. Because we wanted to bring facts and solid analysis to the discussion on the future of the EB5 Regional Center Program, the one thing that we saw was to go to the federal government itself to ask them to provide the information for each regional center has to provide every year of their actual activities, their amount of investment activity and the amount of capital that they raise and those kinds of things. And first time, obviously, we asked, they said no. And so so IIUSA filed a Freedom of Information Act request, which then the USCIS had to comply with. And they provided I-924A filings, those required annual reports from all the regional centers, to IIUSA.
Jeff, I just want to explain to our audience what an I-925A report is. So it's a filing that every regional center has to do at the end of the year, which counts up how much they've invested and how much investment has gone into the projects in regional center and how many jobs they estimate they've created.
And then what we were able to do from that information is we were able to look at and total up the capital investment construction activity in each and every state in the country that happened over those two periods. And the important thing to understand is that this was actual activity, not planned activity, which would come in I-526 filings, for example, or an exemplar project filing under a regional center. This was the information that each one of the regional centers that were responsible for filing an I-924A had to report on their actual project activity, not planned activity, but what actually happened in those 2 years. So we thought that that was a very superior database, and it was factually driven because the regional centers have a responsibility under the penalties of perjury of reporting all those project activities accurately. And we took that information and we put it into each one of the individual states. We took all the individual states and put it into the four regions that were defined by the Census Bureau. And we used that as the input information under which we scored the economic impacts, including jobs, output, and income.
Wow. How long did all of that take?
About 3.5 months in total. After we got the reports from the USCIS through the Federal Freedom of Information Act request.
Which probably took a while. And that's why we're talking about years 2014 and 2015. And the report was just released a month ago. That makes sense. That makes sense.
Jeff, I have to congratulate you on this report for the way it's been written. I've read economic reports. I have been reading economic reports for so many years, and they do put you to sleep. This is not an economic report. Listeners, please go and read this report. It is mind-boggling, the amount of data that they have used, that Jeff has used and his company has used, and the way they have put this together. It's well-written. It engages you throughout. Jeff, where can we tell our viewers to find this report?
Well, of course, they can go to your website. But if they want to get lost in a myriad of economic data and things like that, they can visit eb5economics.com and they will find a copy of it posted on our website. And thank you for the kind words. We spent a long time writing it. And even though we think it's instructive to practitioners in the EB5 space, like immigration attorneys and investors, the audience really was the policymakers in Washington, D.C., because we wanted them to recognize and understand that if they make changes to the program and those changes aren't helpful to having a successful EB-5 program, there was an awful lot of economic opportunity and job opportunities in particular that they would be putting at risk if they didn't make the right policy choices. And so, you know, we still subscribe to the notion that facts matter, even in this society that and situation we find ourselves in Washington, D.C. And so that's why we wanted to be crystal clear about the broad and geographically diverse impacts of EB-5 projects, no matter where they were located, that everybody in every part of the country has an interest in seeing the EB-5 program be a successful program.
I couldn't agree more. And Jeff, if I could just quote something that you've put in the report, that job creation, U.S. capital investment, the economic contributions quantified in the study will merely represent a lost opportunity for the U.S. economy, with literally tens of billions of future foreign investment dollars and hundreds of thousands of new U.S. job opportunities over the coming years hanging in the balance. Wow. QED.
Yes, thank you for that, Mona. And Jeff, thank you for writing that down right here in the report. So it's easy to find that these tens of billions of future foreign investment dollars could be lost. Let me ask you, having done this report and look at what it's meant in the past and what it could mean in the future, or these lost opportunities in the future, what should be our next steps?
Well, I think number one in the immediate future is anybody who has an interest in the EB-5 program, whether it's a project developer or a regional center, or an EB-5 service provider or an investor. Number one is to, you know, contact policymakers in Washington that they may know, whether through representatives or senators or committee staff, to let them know that this is important and that they need to make rational decisions. Over the longer run, with regard to the future of the program, in the longer run, I think what we're going to do is we're going to try to tackle those parts of the EB-5 program's effect that haven't been included in this study, which is, you know, exclusively based on the capital investment of EB-5 projects under the Regional Center Program. Maybe we can figure out a way to get, for example, estimates of the activity attributable to the direct program, which is the permanent part of the program, but also on those other two aspects of the program that we weren't able to identify data that we could do an assessment of the economic contribution of those components, the operations, you know, the hotels after they're built, you know, they serve customers, all the businesses after they are built serve customers. And then lastly, get some more robust information about the household expenditures of the investors themselves when they come and establish their residency in the United States. Frequently, they buy homes, they buy cars. An awful lot of the investors who come to this country do so they can send their children to college. And usually they go to college here in the United States without the benefit of a lot of discounts that a lot of our domestic students have. So the colleges get the full tuition and room and board associated with the students that come in as part of these investor households. There are other reasons why people come to the country, but one, under this program, but one of them is for educational opportunity for their kids.
Right. And even without that quantitative accuracy, we can probably all agree here after listening to this interview that qualitatively, we know that those actual numbers are going to be even higher. Well, Jeff Carr, thank you so much for coming back on EB-5 Investment Voice.
Let's hope it's not 3 years in the future.
Or rather, 3 years in the future, Jeff, with the great news to tell us about how we now have 50,000 visas.
Right, and we tripled the economic impact that we measured back in February of 2019.
We could all appreciate that on every side of the aisle.
Thank you for being with us today on EB-5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB-5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.